By now, you've heard about Global Poker, one of the fastest growing online card rooms available in the US and Canada today. So what's stopping you from trying it out? Global Poker is a safe and secure social poker site that uses their own patented sweepstakes model. Signing up is easy. You can use Google, Facebook, or just an email address. You can always play for free on Global Poker, but you can also buy gold coins for additional play, which will earn sweeps coins that can be redeemed for real cash to a bank account, Skrill account, or even as a gift card. Get a free 5,000 gold coins when you sign up right now at globalpoker.com.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Hello and welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the poker authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 131, featuring Phil Galfond. Phil has done pretty much everything in the world of poker. Not only is he considered one of the best to ever play the game, but he's also been a prolific poker coach and even operated his very own online poker site. In fact, Galfond recently sold that online poker site, Run It Once, to Rush Street Interactive, and together plan to eventually roll out the platform to regulated US markets. His poker training site of the same name features some of the most elite players in the game today, and now Phil is sharing his knowledge with an exclusive PLO course available at runitonce.com. The 37-year-old is one of the best high-stakes PLO players in the world and has proven that with his ongoing Galfond Challenge, taking on anyone willing to battle him in PLO. He's now 4-0 in the challenge, which included an incredible $900,000 come-from-behind win. And although he's always been more focused on cash games, he has had plenty of tournament success, including 3 World Series of Poker bracelets. Anyway, that's enough intro. Here is my conversation with Phil Galfond.
I am here with Phil Galfond. Phil, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. You have to be doing better. You know, you just made the news for selling your company, which we'll talk about a little bit. How you feeling off of that big news?
Oh, good. You know, I've been sitting on it for a little while. We actually, completed the sale back in around Christmas time, end of December. And so I've been anxious to let everybody know, especially, let everybody in the U.S. know we'd be on the way.
Break the news yet. One of those embargoed situations, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I definitely want to talk about, Phil Galfond, the businessman. But before we get to that, we got to talk about Phil Galfond, the poker player. Actually, before we get that, let's get to Phil Galfond, the child. Let's go back to North Potomac, Maryland. What were you getting into at that time of your life?
Okay. So how young are we going? I guess I was, I don't know. I was a nice, quiet kid. I played a lot of sports.
What did mom and dad do?
So mom was a preschool teacher. Dad was he worked in consulting. So his degree is in statistics, but he did like business consulting.
Okay. So was there an emphasis on you to, stay in school and go to college and do all that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you said sports. Were you a competitive kid?
I wouldn't consider myself an amazing athlete, but I was very competitive as a person. And yeah, it was a big focus of mine. And I mostly played soccer throughout like elementary school and middle school. And then in high school, I just played football. And that was like especially towards like in my teenage years, that just became kind of like took over my life, at least in my own mind.
What position?
I was running back.
Okay. Okay, you found the hole, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
how was How are you looking stats-wise? We look getting offers from colleges, or was it just a?
No, I mean, so at my school, I was good. We were like 1-9 or 2-8 every year. And for my school, I was good, but we were not good. I'm 5'6", and I wasn't gonna be. On my way to the NFL.
There have been a couple of shorter statured running backs to do well. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. It's a tougher position to break through for sure. Yeah. Okay. Any glory games you could tell us about?
I had one game that, I mean, we lost as we often did, but it was funny though, because we were playing. Basically, like, we had a coach that took it way too seriously for how not big a deal it was at our school. And we were playing this game. We were probably down by, I want to say in the first half, we were probably down like 3 to 4 touchdowns. and I hurt my arm, and the medic basically said to my coach, like, he can't play. And my coach said, absolutely not, get in there, Galfond. And so I had broken my arm. I didn't know at the time, but I think I scored 4 touchdowns that game. I mean a whole bunch of yards, but we still lost.
I mean, that's a moral victory if I've ever
yeah heard. yeah
look at you powering through with a broken arm. Tim Tebow had a similar story. I think his was a broken leg though. Not to one up you, let's talk about college, because you went away from home, traveled to Madison, Wisconsin for college. What was involved in that decision?
Honestly, I was never – I didn't really like school. I was not that excited about college in general, but, you know, it was kind of like you'd mentioned, it was not an option to not go to college, and I was procrastinating about filling out college applications, and my mom just filled out a bunch of college applications for me. And so I ended up, I got into a bunch of schools. And then it was time to start narrowing it down. And really what, I mean, I went and visited Wisconsin. I went and visited a few, but really what sold me on Madison, Wisconsin was that I, you know, as when you're that age, everybody asks you, you know, where are you thinking about going to school? And every time that would come up, and I'd list some of the places I was thinking about, you know, you'd hear some people who eventually know somebody who went somewhere, and there were a few people who knew somebody that went to Wisconsin, and they were the most glowing reviews of all of what I heard. You know, my cousin goes to Wisconsin, absolutely loves it, says it's amazing. And so that was actually just what sold it for me, was other people's experience.
Yeah, my wife's cousin went to Wisconsin and always talks about how amazing it was.
Yeah, it's great.
It's a college city, right? College town for sure. Party school while still being academically pretty solid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I went to Florida, so I understand how it is. You know, Gainesville, Titletown, a little different than, you know, but you understand how it is. What I want to talk about is the lore of Phil Hellmuth, because he went to Madison, Wisconsin. Yeah. You were getting into poker at the time. Your name is Phil. Was there any mention of the great one, Mr. Hellmuth, while you were in college?
I mean, not so much, because my poker friends that I found online and my school friends were almost entirely different. I knew a couple of people in school that played poker, but for the most part, you know, my friends at school didn't know about poker, so they wouldn't know about Phil Hellmuth. And then my poker friends online didn't really care about associating him with Wisconsin where I was. So no, it wasn't something that came up often.
Man, and there's no statue to him out on campus somewhere?
No, there should be, though, shouldn't there?
Put the two of you side by side with, like, a high five?
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
That would be cool.
Come on, Madison. Honor your greats.
Put me on a stool.
It's about to... That's right. You'd have to get a jump in there, I think. He's a very tall man.
Yeah.
Maybe he could do the low five. So how did you discover poker?
So I played card games. I mean, I guess you can call it poker, but weird, you know, carnival game, poker games with my friends growing up, from like 12 to 18. It was like the main thing we did as friends, you know, got together and played games, and it was never, nobody was that much better than the others. The games were, I mean, a lot of the games were kind of stupid, so there wasn't a ton of strategy, but I never thought of it strategically. And it wasn't until, but I liked to gamble, and my friends liked to gamble, and that was that. When I was in school in Wisconsin, the end of my freshman year, one of my friends from back home won a tournament on party poker for $30,000 and became the talk of our friend group from back home. And he actually reached out to me specifically and said, "Hey, Phil, I've been studying poker a little bit. I picked up some books and I've been taking it seriously and I've gotten kind of good. And I think you'd really like this and I think you'd be really good at it." And so I mean, I didn't need much convincing. I was like, "All right, that sounds great."
Man, that guy changed your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the better, for the worse, is you know, we'll get to be seen. But shout out to that guy for spotting your natural abilities, I guess.
Yeah, shout out to Adam.
Good going, Adam. Okay, so was he right? Were you like you know, a fish to water right away, or was it, you know, a little bit of a bumpy start?
You know, looking back, it's hard to tell because I picked it up pretty quickly. I started playing Sit and Goes and found the 2+2 forums very fast. And the 2+2 Sit and Go forum, you know, at that time, there was a lot of great strategy in there. And I became a winner pretty quickly. And it's hard to say, I don't know, everybody talks about how much easier the games were back then than they are today. But I became a small winner pretty quickly at the, you know, $10 Sit and Goes. So I guess I took to it quickly.
Meanwhile, what was the plan in college?
So I was studying philosophy and still didn't really have a career plan. I mean, I was playing poker. At this point, I wasn't thinking it would be my career. I just was having fun and trying to make a little money. But I still, like, I didn't have a career path planned out really at all. I was just taking philosophy courses because I enjoyed them.
So just, you know, working towards that degree, the bankroll's building, watching American Idol on the side, I'm assuming.
Sure, yeah.
When is there a turning point, or was there like a, you know, a big score or just a light bulb moment where you thought, okay, I could do this for a living?
It was really, I mean, it was steady growth in Sit and Go world. And I was basically, I had moved up. I mean, yeah, it was steady. I would jump stakes every once in a while, and most of the time it went well. And so I went from tens to, I remember the points that I stopped at for longer. It was tens, 30s, 100s. And then I was like, you know, $100 to $200 Sit and Go player. There were these step tournaments that were like 1K and 2K back then. And I would play those sometimes, but kind of take shots at those. And it was, I had around, I think I just turned 21, and a friend of mine, Peter Jetton, who I knew from the Sit and Go forums. Yep. He, I don't remember how, but he convinced me to try switching to cash games because he had done that. And so I switched around then to no limit cash. A few things, I mean, that year, the year that I turned 21, a lot of things happened. So I switched to no limit cash, and then I hired Tommy Angelo as a coach. And I might be getting the timeline wrong. I'm pretty sure this is when it was. So I hired Tommy Angelo as a coach. I met up with him in Las Vegas. It was like a 3-day coaching session. And I hired him because I was seeking out cash game coaches, but actually he was a cash game player, but, and a coach, but really what he taught was more how to be a poker player, like your career as a poker player, being a poker professional, more than, actually strategy at the table. And I found that kind of eye-opening, you know. I mean, he's fantastic. And I found that eye-opening. And then really I think far and away the biggest shift for me was that summer. I went to Las Vegas for the World Series of Poker for my first time ever. And I stayed in the house with, I think it was five other guys, maybe four or five other guys that were all, I met in the Sit and Go forums. Peter Jetton was one of them. And it was the first time I'd like watched other people play poker. And I think that I learned more, you know, during that month and a half than during any year previously. And that I think was the biggest turning point in kind of my skill level. And I actually had a bad summer. I lost like half my bankroll taking shots at 5,100, when there were good games. And so I financially, it was not a turning point for me, but skill wise, I think I progressed a ton that year. And it was, you know, 1 year later, I was playing, you know, the big games like 200, 400 on Full Tilt.
This was 06, your first series?
That sounds, yeah.
It does show you how you have two small caches in that series. I'm assuming tournaments were never really on your radar.
They were never a main focus. So as a sit and go player, I felt like, you know, I knew push fold stuff. I knew, you know, how to play short stacks. So
yeah,
I felt pretty comfortable in tournaments back then. But it was never, I've never been a multi-table tournament player. It's never been my focus and never really even been like a side focus. It's just been, you know, they're fun to play and sometimes they're very good and there's glory and prestige attached to them, and so I've played them over time, but yeah, I went from a sit and go player to a cash player.
When you were jumping up to like 200, 400 and stuff, was there PLO involved yet, or was that later to go?
No, that was later, not yet. I was just a no limit player for the at least through like 2007 and maybe into 2008 as well.
I only ask because your bracelet in 2008 did come in pot limit Omaha.
Yeah, so I when I won that, I had just started playing PLO. I want to probably at the beginning of that year.
Okay, so you win the bracelet. We'll talk about that in a second. It does come with 800 grand. And, you know, to a lot of people looking at the only tracked results we could find online, that's your first big score. Does 800 grand even change your life too much at that point? Or are you already, you know, playing big cash at that time?
I'm already playing big cash at that time. So I was playing, the summer of 2007 is when I don't remember where between 2006 and 2007. I just can remember that in the summer of 2007, I was playing, you know, 100, 200 plus. And then 2008, by then I was playing, I'd played, like they were even doing the half games at that point. I was playing big, yeah. So it was not life-changing money, and well, no money was life-changing money because I wasn't spending any money anyways. I was just it was just my bankroll.
You like treated like a video game score, you just wanted to run up forever?
Yeah, I mean, at that point in my life, the only, like, I bought maybe a TV worth like, you know, $2,000-$3,000, and I hadn't spent, I like, I all the only, my lifestyle was different than my friends at college in that, you know, I bought a nice TV and I would order food. I would order, you know, I would order $20 dinners when I wanted to. And that was it.
You know, you live the high life in Madison.
Yeah. Yeah.
At any point, did the stakes bother you at all? Was there an adjustment for stomaching the swings of those games?
Not really. And I think it was because it was just kind of a video game at that point. I mean, obviously I understood what I was playing for, but I, you know, I was surrounded by people who were all broke and happy. And I was, you know, like all my, especially because like all my friends at school were friends already. And I didn't live a different lifestyle. So I just didn't, I cared definitely, but I don't know. I didn't associate a lot of value. I didn't associate like happiness with it so much because, or worth, like my friends didn't care that I was successful. And, yeah, I don't know. It was just a separate thing. It was a game.
How would you rate your level of gamble on a scale of 1 to 10?
I guess that depends. That depends what is what we consider good and bad. I was very willing to gamble.
Okay.
I was very comfortable gambling.
Have you found that your whole career you've been a healthy shot taker?
Yeah, I always like to take shots because first of all, I mean, I always liked to gamble. I think that I, you know, even before poker, before, you know, gambling with an edge, I enjoyed gambling. So, you know, I liked to gamble already. And then with poker, I was very, I don't know, I really wanted to kind of, I guess, if we're going to continue with the game analogy, like I wanted to reach the end of the game. And so I was always very ambitious with what I wanted to achieve in poker, and kind of taking shots always felt like a potential shortcut to getting there, which often would be a bad way to approach it. But I think in a lot of ways it worked out well for me because actually the motivation was so strong. So I would, you know, play 5-10 no limit, which is my main game, and I would take a shot at 5,100 and, you know, lose 40,000, and then go back to 5-10 and get so motivated to grind it back so that I could take another shot. And I think for a lot of people, you know, they're playing 5-10, they're buying in for $1,000, they go lose $40,000 and they struggle to step back down because it just feels like they can't catch up to what they just lost. But for me, it didn't bother me stepping back down, and I just found it very motivating to grind and work harder and be able to do that exciting thing again.
So, let's talk about the bracelet. You win your first in 2008, 800 grand PLO event, but the bracelet itself, what does that mean to you at that point in your career? Did you care at all, or was it just a foregone conclusion that you'd get one?
No, it meant a whole lot to me. That point in my career, I definitely had a chip on my shoulder because I was playing in the biggest games online and against the best players. But I was not kind of, you know, outside of the online community, not known or respected. And that bothered me at that point. And I kind of, you know, it's funny because you go from every, you have this, mindset, or at least I did, of like, look, tournaments are in some ways meaningless. You know, there's so much variance, and whoever wins a whatever 300 person tournament is just going to be the one who's more or less the luckiest that day. And you could go for years and years without ever winning a bracelet, even if you're the best player in the field. So in a sense, it's meaningless, but at the same time, I really want it. I want that recognition, even if I don't think that's what should garner recognition. And so it meant a lot to me. I had that chip on my shoulder and really wanted to win one. And that was kind of, so that was one of the things, like I mentioned, shot, like grinding to shot take. I also liked the idea of grinding to shot take in big tournaments. Like at that point, I guess in my career, I was already playing big, but the year prior, before I was playing big, I had this plan in my mind of like, okay, I'm going to grind this much and be able to play, you know, a certain number of World Series events or World Series circuit events or WPT events. And then I have to grind back down again, or, you know, drop back down, grind again. And like, basically like my initial plan, this plan didn't last long because I changed my mind, but, I thought I would try to just play as many 10K tournaments as I could throughout the year by just saving up grinding to do so. But anyways, so all that to say, I cared about having some success on a bigger stage.
Yeah, like, you know, obviously that gives you some recognition. You did have another big score a few years later, a runner-up in the 25K. You do show up at the series to play the big events. You won another bracelet in 2015 in the Deuce to Seven single draw event. And then also won the PLO 8 or better event in 2018. So you have three bracelets. I always ask, where do you keep your bracelets?
So usually they're lost, but I think that my wife has them now, so they're in good hands. I don't keep track of them very well.
Oh, okay, so they're not out on, like, displayed or anywhere.
No, they're not on display.
When's the last time you wore them?
I think that it's been a few years, maybe two or three years, and I think I was showing my niece who was interested.
All right. So they do see the light of day every once in a while. That's good.
Yeah, occasionally.
All right. Let's talk about the training site. Run It Once.
Yeah.
When did you decide to share all your secrets?
So I always enjoyed teaching. I think had I not found poker, I think I would have ended up being a teacher of some sort. And I enjoyed sharing strategy. So, like, early in my career, I was still a sit-and-go player. At some point, I started writing articles for Bluff Magazine, strategy articles. And I wanted to write articles long before then. I remember I reached out to, because 2+2 had, like, a online article, like, online magazine. And I reached out to them and said, hey, would you, you know, could I, like, it was pretty funny in hindsight. I asked if I could write for them and kind of gave my credentials, and they were like, okay, we'll write an article and we'll see. I didn't feel like doing the work if it wasn't, I don't know. Like, no, you just tell me if you want it first. So I didn't end up, but I did end up writing articles for Bluff Magazine a little bit later, and, you know, shared a lot of strategy, and I really liked it. I always had, you know, hesitancy making training videos. And so I had thought about it on and off, and Card Runners, which was, you know, almost a monopoly at the time, reached out to me. I guess actually that's an overstatement, but they were far and away the industry leader at the time. They reached out to me. It must have been around 2007 or 2008. I don't know. And asked if I would make videos, and I ended up making one video for them, and it was really well received, and I really enjoyed it. They made me an offer that I didn't like, and so I didn't end up making videos for them long term. But right then, like, I just knew I really enjoyed it, and if I'm being honest, you know, I thought I was very good at it, and it's kind of fun to do things that you're good at. So I got a lot of satisfaction out of teaching people.
When did you set up the site?
Well, so I first worked with another site, which was Blue Fire Poker, a training site. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to remember all the dates now, but I made
videos. There were a lot of sites in the day.
There were, yeah. So I made videos there for a while, and then decided to Run It Once. Essentially just, so it's funny, my co-founder, his name's Dan Quinn, at Run It Once, we had discussed making a poker training site in 2007. And we like started to work on it, and then ended up, we were both poker players and we were too busy and decided not to do it. But we ended up having the conversation again. And in 2012, finally did co-found a poker training site together, and that was Run It Once. I mean, the decision to do it was kind of, I knew I wanted to make videos, and I thought that we could do it better than others were, and bring a level of professionalism and polish that didn't exist elsewhere. And so at the time we launched Run It Once, basically every training site was $29 a month, and they put out, you know, 2 videos 1 week, 1 video the next week, 3 videos the next week. The websites were, well, with a couple exceptions, the websites were not very pretty. And we just decided that we could, like, we ended up charging for our elite subscription $100 a month, because that's what we knew it was going to take to have enough money coming in to hire the best coaches. Mm-hmm. And also to put out videos every day. We put out 2 videos a day since our launch in 2012. We wanted to approach it with, but we just basically, like, we wanted the conversation to be not, you know, what is the best training site, just obviously Run It Once is the best. Is it worth 3 times as much as what they're charging? And it, you know, it worked very well, because it did, we did kind of immediately become considered the best, and immediately became a market leader without much, I don't want to say effort, because it took a lot of effort, but without any marketing, really.
There was never any hesitancy on your part to share your own personal strategies, especially considering what stakes you were playing for?
Yeah, once I started doing it, I felt fine about it. The one thing that I was careful not to do is, if there were, because I would release high stakes videos against, you know, people I was playing against.
Yeah, exactly.
I would tend to not, if there was like one player in the game with, like, I don't know, a huge leak in some way that I was always taking advantage of, I would try to talk around that specifically. But
just,
I
keep that
always,
for yourself.
Yeah, because that, and I've always wanted to share everything, but I kind of justified that to myself as, like, this isn't going to help everybody else. It's only going to hurt me, and it's going to help that guy. So that's kind of the only thing I held back, was if I had a very specific read on a very specific opponent. And otherwise, I don't know. I was worried about it at first, but once I started making videos and continued to be able to win, I don't know, I stopped worrying about it.
Has any other player ever confronted you over a video? Maybe not in an angry way, but just like saying, like, hey, thanks for giving me props.
I think so. The one thing that stands out to me, and I could be misremembering, I don't remember where he said this, but I maybe heard it through the grapevine, but there was a video I made a long time ago, and this was before Run It Once, against playing like 100, 200 heads up, no limit, against Peter Eastgate. And he, I don't know where I heard it, but he said that, you know, after that he stopped, like, he watched the video and he stopped trying to play against, like, top players heads up, no limit, because he was just like, oh, I need to be more careful.
Yeah, you killed your own action there.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, well, what's going on with Run It Once today? The training site, I should say.
So the most, I mean, what stands out to me the most when you ask that is I released a course. It's the first course I've ever released. So I've released, for over a decade, just I've made training videos, but they've always been just one-off videos, usually of reviewing my own gameplay in an unstructured manner. And that's because that's how I enjoy teaching. But I decided after these heads up challenges from the last couple of years to organize my learnings, I guess, on heads up PLO and PLO in general, but it is, it's on PLO in general, but it's taught through the lens of heads up, or the concepts that apply to all PLO and sometimes to all poker, taught through the lens of heads up, because that's where I have kind of hand histories and experience. And so I spent, I don't know how long, a long time, because it's a ton of videos, making this course in the second half of the last year. And we released it in early access in January, and it's going to be completed in the coming months. And then, so basically, like, it's probably 90% complete, but I wanted to get it out and get feedback from users and decide what to round it out with. And so that's what we've done, at a discounted price. And then, I'll finish it up in the coming months and kind of give it the full launch at a higher price.
Well, there you have it, guys. Go check out Phil's new PLO course at Run It Once. You did mention these heads-up matches. I want to talk about the Galfond Challenge. Where are we with that? Oh, actually, first, what was your inspiration for this? I have to assume it was born out of some necessity to find action as well, right?
Sort of. So it was a few things, and I'll try to not tell a 30-minute long story. But I had some work with Elliot Rowe, who's a mental game coach. I'd realized that I'd been spending a lot of time on Run It Once poker and Run It Once training, and not playing poker much at all for a little while. And I had realized that that was not making me happy, and that my true passion, even though I enjoyed teaching, I really valued and had a lot of passion for the mission of Run It Once Poker, and the mission of Run It Once Training. But the actual day-to-day work was not fulfilling me like playing poker was. My passion was playing poker. And so I realized through work with him that I needed to get back to playing poker. And so I started to play a little bit here and there. And then the realization or the idea for the Galfond Challenge actually came to me when I was working on Run It Once Training and talking with the team, going through, we go through our roster of coaches and we see, you know, who's getting the most views. We look at how much we're paying each coach, you know, compared to how many of our users are watching their videos and things like that. So we make sure to keep a roster and, you know, keep a roster that people really want to watch videos from. And I noticed that my video views had been dropping, and I had the realization that like, oh, well, I guess it kind of makes sense that people don't want to learn from me as much as they used to, because I'm not out there playing poker. They don't see that I'm out there beating people. So I guess that makes sense. And
it's like 2008 all over again.
Yeah.
You got to come out of the shadows every once in a while to show the young kids who you are.
Yeah. Exactly. So I was like, you know what? I want to show that I can. And so the first idea was actually just to challenge, kind of an open challenge to other coaches from any training site that was not Run It Once. And I laid 4-1 odds on a match of, I forget how many hands I said initially, but anyways, then as I was
thinking, very confident.
Yeah. And I, as I was thinking about that, I was like, well, putting that out is, you know, going to let people know that I still think I can play and they should still be learning from me. But I actually didn't expect that I would get any takers. And I really, as the more I thought about it, I didn't want to just do it as a gimmick. I really wanted to play. So I did release that offer, but I also said, for anybody who's not a training site coach, reach out and let's see if we can, you know, if we can battle. And so I got a lot of people reaching out. I actually did get taken up on it, on a modified version of that by one coach, which was Chance Cornith. But then everybody else I played was not a coach. And some of them, you know, I didn't lay odds. It was 1-1. Some I laid less odds, et cetera. And started to play some matches. And also as I started that, I realized how it could help Run It Once poker as well. And it actually became, you know, more of a boon for Run It Once poker than for Run It Once training, because I got to get more eyes on the platform there.
All right. Before we talk about Run It Once poker, let's finish off with the Galfond Challenge, because there was a moment, highly publicized moment. You're playing Veni Vidi, right? PLO match. I think you laid him 2-1.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
He's
so,
a good negotiator.
He's a good player, as well. So, you know, he has you down 900,000, right?
Yeah.
900. What are you feeling? Because this is not like, for people listening who don't know, this isn't one day. This is, you know, many, many weeks long, each match. So you're playing 25,000 hands. So at one point you're down $900,000 and you have the prospect of paying him another 200 grand on top of it.
Yeah.
What are you feeling in those moments?
I mean, I was more kind of dejected than anything, because this was the first match I played, and so I had kind of come out of retirement to play a bunch of matches. And I mean, I never considered myself retired, but more, you know, air quotes retirement. I came out of not playing to, and I was really excited about it. I was working hard to prepare, and I was feeling pretty confident going into the match. And then I just show up on a big stage and just get smacked around. So I was feeling, I mean, I thought that I was running bad, but I also, you know, was questioning myself. And even if I were not questioning myself, it's still just a bummer that, yeah, well, it's never fun to lose, and it's never fun to lose on a huge stage, and it's never fun to lose huge, right off the bat. It would have been one thing if it were like my second challenge and I had won my first challenge, and here I was, you know, encountering some adversity and some swings, but this was just like, I showed up. A lot of people kind of were excited to bet against me, expecting that, you know, my time off had hurt me, and I was, you know, kind of proving them right. And so I was bummed. I was stressed, but it was more just kind of bummed than stressed. I wasn't, the stress levels were not insanely high.
Let's talk of, okay, so you somehow managed to turn the tide and claw your way back to a very tiny win. Was that a result of you finding some sort of leak that you were making? Or was it just a matter of variance finally evening out? Or
I think it was both. I considered, when I was down 900,000, I considered quitting. And when I decided to come back, I had no expectation of actually winning the match. I thought, you know, I want to prove to myself especially, but everybody that I can hang with this guy. And I, you know, maybe over the last, whatever, 14,000 hands or whatever we had left, I wanted to win, 10 buy-ins or something, you know, win 100,000, win 200,000 back. And I thought I could do that. I think that, you know, the changes that I made in my game, my improvements, maybe made me a favorite to, like, I think I was a favorite at that point, but not a favorite to actually make the full comeback. I think there was some variance, or a lot of variance, involved in that. The biggest change that I made was actually kind of going back to a little bit more of old me, because I prepared for this challenge with, you know, it was the first time I prepared with, like, the first time I'd ever studied with solvers, which sounds crazy. Wow. Late for a lot of people, but No Limit Hold'em solvers had been around for a long time, PLO solvers not as much. And I wasn't playing No Limit Hold'em anymore. So then, kind of by the time PLO solvers came out, it was like 1 or 2 years that I just was still playing but ignoring them, and then a couple of years where I just stopped playing. So it had been several years that they'd been out and I hadn't touched them. And so when I studied, I was trying to brush up on theory because I had never looked at it. And I came in over-focused on that, essentially. And I had trying to execute a game plan. And it's great to focus on that. What I lost was hand reading. And when I mean lost, I mean, like, it wasn't a part of my thought process so much. Was just trying to figure out what was the theoretically correct thing to do in this spot, and reading his hand didn't really enter my mind so much in the beginning of the match. And so the shift that I had was, you know, yes, now some of these things that I'd learned have become a little bit more automatic, and now I have both the bandwidth and the recognition of the importance of trying to focus on reading his hand.
There you go. Well, you've gone on to beat Chance Cornith, as you mentioned, also Brandon Adams, and I think your match with Bill Perkins is over. Can't quite tell on that one.
That's a good question. It's not technically over, but we've had a lot of trouble trying to schedule it.
Either way, you're up in that one as well, so things are going good in the Galfond Challenge. What is the official terms for anybody listening out there? You're taking on anybody in PLO, right?
Well, so I'm taking anyone. So here's what's changed since the beginning of the Galfond Challenge is that I'm now pretty settled here in Las Vegas. And I also learned how long these matches take. So I thought I would go, like, I went up to Vancouver to play these matches. I thought I was going to knock out like 5 matches in 6 months. And it turned out that I knocked out 2 in, it was like 5 and a little bit months. And I don't want to plan a 5-month trip somewhere again. And so the open offer is not maybe as impressive as it seems, because I'm looking for anybody who will play me in PLO that I can play from here, which is on WSOP.com is the only option now, in the regulated market. So,
well, the poker world's about to be in Vegas pretty soon, so
it's true.
There's no excuses.
Yeah, so it is open to anybody that wants to play me here at 200, 400 PLO. And then I'm also just looking for other potential action. I've really wanted the motivation and excuse to learn or relearn No Limit Hold'em. And so I would love a half challenge or a No Limit challenge against somebody who is, you know, who I have a good chance against having just started. Because basically, like, I mean, we're talking about my timeline, 2008, 2009, maybe 20, I don't know, like, 2009, 2010, that might be the last time that I played No Limit Hold'em seriously.
Really? Wow.
So it's been within give or take a year or two. Yeah, I've just been a PLO player. I played some mixed games, but it's been a long time since I've played No Limit. I think that I'm capable of learning it and playing it at a reasonably high level. I'd love a reason to. So it's kind of any takers at PLO, but open to anybody at PLO, not open to anybody in the world at No Limit or half, but I'm hoping to get some interest from people who, you know, the match feels fair.
There you go. Get your bankrolls ready, guys. Let's talk about the actual Run It Once web poker site. Mm-hmm. So you're running a training site and you go, you know what? We could do this better. We could do our own thing better, right? Let's start our own online poker site. Is that kind of how it went?
More or less. It was at the time. Well, at the time of the kind of conception of it, it was when a lot of people were really frustrated with PokerStars about some of the changes they were making and the way that they were treating players. And we had some fears as players about the direction of the online poker industry, which at that point, you know, PokerStars was almost a monopoly. And with them going in a direction of, you know, towards faster game formats with lower edge and higher rake and less rewards, we got nervous about the future of online poker. And so I think that we need some players involved in poker site decisions. And I do think we're good at designing products. I do think that we are good at designing policies and features that a poker site could have and have ideas that could combat issues in the industry. So yeah, let's just try it.
And what actually is the process for that? How does one just start a website from scratch?
I mean, it's a lot to bite off. So we hired a couple of people who had industry experience, who had worked at PokerStars, and to kind of guide us through it. And I mean, really lead the process. And, you know, at first there was not even, like, in the early days where we're just kind of building out a staff and getting set up from a regulatory perspective, starting to plan the software development, like, we weren't even, I wasn't even that involved. I didn't know the first thing about regulation and I mean, really how to, you know, what the needs of an online poker site were. So kind of leaned on their expertise. And then, yeah, I had to work on the software development, which is obviously a key aspect. And I mean, I was involved in that as much as I could be as a non-technical person, but yeah, I don't know. That's how we got started, is we got a couple of experts in to guide us through it.
Well, I imagine there's a lot of things that as a player you want and feel an online poker site needs. Yeah. And then you talk to the developers and they're just like, well, you know, that would work well if we didn't want to make money, or if it was possible, or if there wasn't this law in place. I imagine it's one of those situations where every time you open a door, there's another six locked doors behind it.
Yeah, it was definitely, I mean, look, we knew we were biting off a lot. It was still biting off more than we expected. And there were always new hurdles. And I mean, truthfully, the biggest challenge by far for us was tech. And it was because I went with a direction with a, you know, like a tech team lead at the beginning that, I mean, frankly, was the wrong choice. And so we started down the wrong path. And eventually when we kind of found a team that we felt better about, they were kind of recovering from the wrong direction that we, you know, that we set out.
Right. Right. I think
like honestly, in hindsight, if I were to start over, the most like obvious, I mean, I think there are a lot of things I would do over again, but the most obvious thing that I would do differently is, you know, start with hiring a extremely expensive tech consultant to help us find the team to start with. Because being non-technical, there's just no good way for me to vet tech talent, you know?
Right. Everyone sounds like a genius.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So you found the company in 2012, and basically ran it, like you said, up until December of last year. What went into the decision to sell to Rush Street Interactive?
Well, so to be clear, there was the training site was 2012. Poker site, I actually don't even remember what year we started it, but it was early 2019 that we launched it.
Where the actual software launched, right?
Yeah, yeah. The decision to sell was essentially it became clear. So I'll try to fast forward through this, but basically, you know, it was a slow start. And then with the Galfond Challenge, with some updates in our software, we actually started to see some decent growth in like late 2019, early 2020, which was then compounded by the pandemic and kind of the growth. I mean, the whole industry grew during 2020. But then after then, when lockdowns eased, the growth stopped and traffic fell back down. And so basically it became clear that we needed more muscle to break through and compete with the other sites, because we had at that point a great product. People loved playing on our site. They loved us. They loved the brand and what we stood for. They loved our customer service. So we had done a lot of things right, albeit a little slower than we planned to initially. But there's just no substitute in online poker for the network effects of having, you know, liquidity, having games running around the clock. And there were so many people who said, you know, I would move all of my volume to Run It Once Poker. Like, I love Run It Once Poker. It's my favorite site. But if you had, you know, 100 no limit running around the clock, I'd be there. And I'd leave PokerStars and just play there. I'd leave GG and just play there, whatever the case may be. But you don't, and we didn't. And in order to have a really good product in poker, you have to A, have a really good product, but then B, have a lot of players. And we just realized that, you know, without a large partnership of some kind, we were just going to be continuing to fight that uphill battle of you know, we can continue to get the product better and better, and we can continue to treat our players well and have people happy when they're playing on our site. We can have, you know, pretty good player retention, but it's just difficult to get and keep players when they have options elsewhere that, you know, they can four table the games that they want whenever they want. And we can't offer that.
What is your thoughts on the online poker market in general as it stands today? I mean, obviously in the United States, it's very fractured given that it's a state by state basis, but even, you know, it's even fractured worldwide. You have specific sites for specific countries. Do we even have the player pool worldwide to do something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely worrisome how the direction that the world's heading in of splitting up, you know, country by country more and more. And I'm very hopeful that, you know, starting in the US, we're going to see more and more states added and sharing liquidity, because it will become obvious to them that is needed in order to have good revenue and good tax revenue from online poker. And I'm hoping and thinking that potentially, you know, starting from the US, this is long term and this is maybe too hopeful, but we start from the US, we have state by state, we have, you know, eventually most US states sharing liquidity with each other. So legal regulated poker in most US states sharing liquidity with each other. And then they start expanding to other regulated markets or sharing liquidity with other regulated markets, probably starting with, you know, Canada. Where Ontario is now just decided to ring fence and have a regulated environment, and then hopefully expanding outward, because I think it's necessary, and I think that what'll end up happening if that doesn't happen, you know, if states don't share liquidity in the next whatever, like in the next 5 years, if we're still at, you know, under 7 states sharing liquidity, I think the sites will lose to your unregulated sites, because it's just so hard to compete. Like, the advantage you have being regulated is you get to advertise in places that you're allowed to. You offer your customers more security. They can feel safer. You have better, well, maybe not better payment options, but payment options that they're like PayPal, for example, that I don't know if you can use PayPal on like ACR, for example. So,
right, a lot of these sites are also partnered with existing brick and mortar casinos.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So you do have advantages there, but having much less liquidity than an unregulated site is a big disadvantage, and you're going to lose customers to them, which is you're going to lose customers to them, states are going to lose tax dollars, and if the kind of states and politicians are concerned about protecting players, they are going to be more protected in a regulated environment. So I think it's on the way, more and more states and more and more sharing liquidity. I think it's what's really necessary for poker in the US to grow, and I think it's what's necessary for poker to thrive eventually in rest of world as well.
All right. Well, we do have some rapid fire questions to close it out, if you are ready to go.
I'll do my best.
All right. You don't have to answer rapidly. I always forget to say that. Okay. You mentioned that you're a natural gambler. If it wasn't for poker, what would your game of choice be?
Blackjack.
Have you ever had some epic blackjack runs?
Yeah, I remember I was a senior in high school and playing on some blackjack site, and I guess I don't even remember the dollar amounts, but I mean I was 18, and it was a ton of money. I think I won like $3,000-$4,000, and then I just was like at school and I couldn't pay attention to anything thinking about it.
Just thinking about splitting eights.
Yep.
About a year and a half ago, you took a lot of heat from the poker community for giving Phil Hellmuth props. And now he's making you look good by winning everything. How do you feel about that?
You know, I feel good about it. I even if he weren't, you know, I'm always happy to kind of share my opinion on how I view things. And I think that specifically, I mean, watching Phil on the duel on Poker Go, I really got to see a lot more of his game and understand a bit more of his game. And he really impressed me there. So even if he didn't go on to win like 90% of those have a bunch of tournament success, I wouldn't feel bad about it. I don't know. The results don't matter too much to me. It's not like people are coming back to me and saying, "Hey, you were right." They just, you know.
Come on, guys. You got to give Phyllis props.
Yeah.
Your wife, Farah, is obviously an actress, and she was on two of the three biggest soap operas of all time. In fact, this is astonishing. She did more than 800 episodes of Days of Our Lives and more than almost 600 episodes of One Life to Live.
Yeah.
My question to you is, how many episodes have you seen?
I've seen zero. I've seen parts of
zero.
She did a stint recently. By recently, I mean 3 years ago, where she did a few episodes and I watched parts of those with her. But yeah, I haven't watched.
Man, you're going to have to do the deep dive binge, right?
I don't think she would want me to. So it's not like I'm doing a bad job of being a husband. I think she'd prefer I not.
Stay out of the soaps, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Your wife is actually quite the player now herself. I assume she gets her training at Run It Once.
She does, yes.
Does she prefer your videos or learning from somebody else?
She prefers learning from other people. I mean, she does. She'll ask me questions, but I think she likes learning from others.
There you go. Yeah, it's probably not the best to hear it from you all the time, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What was your best shot that you ever took? One that really paid off for you?
So if it's that open-ended, I think then I probably have to go with meeting up with my wife for the first time.
Oh, there you go. Smooth talker, earning the points.
Yeah.
How did that go? So was that just a shot in the dark by you? I mean, Hollywood actress, you're just a degen poker player. How does that work?
It was a slow developing romance that started over Twitter, and started with her. She followed me as I guess you could call her a poker fan. She loved poker. And long story short, eventually like replied to one of my tweets, to which I replied back. And then over months and months, there were a few more instances like that. Eventually we were talking. Well, she DM'd me eventually because I had followed her back. And then, but we were living in two different places. And so eventually I just said, she was in LA, I was in Vancouver. And I have friends in LA. Eventually I just said, "Hey, I'm going to be visiting my best friend in LA. Do you want to meet up while I'm there?" And I mean, I did go visit my best friend, but the purpose of the trip was to meet Farah. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Does your new place in Vegas have a slide?
No. Well, a very small, wooden slide for my son. It's not attached to anything. It's not built in.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, go check out Phil's slide in his New York City penthouse from back in the day. Do you miss that place?
I do a little bit. I like it here, but yeah, that was fun.
That's what I'm saying. You've lived all over. I mean, do you have a preference given the weather?
I prefer. You know, it's funny. If you'd asked me a while ago, I would have said that I didn't like Vegas weather, but now I've gotten used to it. So I guess here, I think my favorite place I've lived is Vancouver, though.
All right. What about your most prized possession?
I mean, I don't know. Is it weird to say my son? He's not really a possession, is he?
No, but I mean, he is your most prized possession.
He is, yeah.
At least until he turns 18.
Yeah.
Then he's your most prized gift to the world.
Yeah.
What about the biggest pot you've ever won or lost? Your choice for pain or pleasure.
Honestly, I don't remember. I think there was a $600,000 or $700,000 pot that I played at Aria. It was in a we were playing this was called the Big Bet Mix. So it was like 12 different games, all no limit and pot limit. And this one was in a no limit or no pot limit double draw high. So five card draw with two draws. And it was just trips versus trips versus trips going into the final draw. And I had the best trips, but one of them filled up and I lost the pot.
Oof.
Yeah.
I didn't think pots for those type of games got so big, but
yeah, if it was one draw, it wouldn't. But when there are a couple draws and a few players with big hands, yeah.
And the stats. All right. Game. What about the best swap or piece you've ever had of anybody?
So I had a. There are two that come to mind. One, I don't remember what year. I was deep in the main. It was 2009. I went deep in the main event. And so on day five or six, I swapped with my friend Jason Sentai, who actually had like half the or like a third of the chips I had. So we did a swap where I had, you know, more of him than him of me, and he went on to final table. I think he got eighth. And then there was
that was 2010, and he got seventh.
Seventh, yeah.
For $1.4 million.
That was a good one, and then. What's the other one? I think I've had a couple of good swaps in because I've had really poor results in the like super high roller tournaments. Like I haven't played them in a while, but like I think a couple of the early what are they called? The Poker Go one.
The super high roller bowls?
Yeah, the super high roller bowls. Basically I've done well in there. I'm not sure if one or two people want me to say, so I'm not going to. But some good swaps there, including one where I actually, like, at the beginning of the tournament, swapped with somebody and gave them, like, I gave them markup with the swap because they were better than me. It turned out to be worth it.
There you go. Yeah. What was your largest non-poker wager?
I mean, I don't, not very big compared to poker. Nothing's coming to mind even.
You stick to poker. That's smart.
Yeah.
What was your worst job before poker?
I answered phones at Domino's and I really hated it because I don't like talking on the phone. It gives me a lot of anxiety. And then their system was so. Their system was so bad because you had to first of all, you had to input everything in the right order. So you'd have to make sure like people would say, you know, I want two large pepperoni and onion, whatever. And you have to say, okay, hold on. What crust? And then you start there. What size? Anyways. And then you would have to there were shortcut keys. You had to press keys for every topping they wanted. And like P was for pepper, not pepperoni. And so I'd make a lot of mistakes, and it was just, it's terrible.
Wait, what do you press for pepperoni then?
I think it was, what was pepperoni? I think it was, no. I remember that sauce, so extra sauce, which wouldn't think was common, but I remember I got asked for it a few times, was X, because S was sausage. I don't remember
what. Oh, okay.
But pepperoni was. It was something else. P was peppers, and it should have been pepperoni.
Get your shit together, Domino's. Do you have a celebrity doppelganger, or have people told you you look like somebody growing up?
For for a little a while ago, I would get Jason Biggs, but I haven't gotten that since I've had more facial hair.
Oh, pre-beard.
Yeah, like 2004.
All right. I'm not seeing that, but
it's not okay. So much. No, I don't think.
Do you have any phobias?
Not any. Nothing like extreme or unusual. I mean, I like bugs less than average, but not, not a crazy amount. And
if I see a roach, I will jump on the table. That's
me. Yeah. Okay, so I'm not quite that bad, but I still probably am. I'm not gonna be happy. Put it that way.
Are you superstitious at all?
I don't think so. No. I mean, I think everybody has a tiny bit of superstition, but I like to think that I'm not.
So you don't have like a favorite hand that's just worked out better for you over than it should have over the long run?
No, you know, it's harder to have those in PLO with four cards.
That's true. What about your longest session ever?
I think probably in the 30 to 35 hour range.
And how did it turn out?
They always go badly. I've had like 3 or 4 sessions over 24 hours and none of them were good.
Was he just trying to get unstuck?
Well, it was more, I mean, I guess so. It was more that they were all live and they were all in great games. So it just felt like I couldn't quit, but I could have.
Do you like telling strangers that you're a professional poker player?
No, I don't mind it. I used to hate it because it was just, you'd get so many questions that, I don't know. I used to really dislike it, and I used to just lie. Like I would, you know, get in a cab and they'd say, "What do you do?" And I'd be like, "Well, I'm a student," you know. But now I don't mind it. I don't mind it so much anymore. I don't know why though. I don't know why that's changed.
Did you have a nemesis, somebody you couldn't beat or somebody who held over you?
I think that, yeah, like Zygmunt, it was Ilari Samis and Phil Ivey. I had the most trouble with them online.
You and everyone else.
Yeah.
Oh, if you had a HUD that showed 3 stats about any person that you looked at in real life, what 3 stats would you want to know?
Oh, man, that's a great question. Okay, so maybe one for current mood.
Oh, that'd be very helpful. You can just avoid people entirely.
Yeah. another for like a honest statement percentage.
Okay, honesty, that's a
so,
good one.
So, like, yeah, percentage of things that they say that are true.
Very helpful for poker.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I don't know. Those two stand out. I can't think of a third.
I think you'll go far with those two.
I think I'm proud of those two, yeah.
We end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator. Do-do-do-do-do-do. How would you do at competitive eating?
I do very well.
Yeah? Do you have a food of choice?
I mean, if we're going for volume, maybe pizza.
Okay. So let's break it down. Let's say I gave you 10 minutes. How many slices can you put down? If, you know, there's something, the world is watching and you really want to do your best.
Okay. I'm going to really think about it.
Do you have like a Kobayashi technique where you can, you know?
No, no technique. I just
compress the belly.
I just don't really get full. I guess
don't get full.
I don't know. I could maybe do.
You don't look like somebody who doesn't get full. 16. So you have great willpower.
I have great willpower on and off. Yeah. But definitely pound for pound, I would do really, really well in an eating contest.
Did you say 16?
Yeah, that's my guess.
16 slices in 10 minutes? Yeah. All right, guys. New prop bet. hit up Phil on Twitter. We got to make this happen. let's put his money where his pizza is. Yeah. Phil, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing the stories.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was fun.
That's it. That is the show. Thank you once again to Phil for the stories. Make sure you go follow him on Twitter at Phil Galfond. And also, don't forget to check out his new PLO course at runitonce.com. Follow us on Twitter at Card Player Media for the latest news from the poker world. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't done so already. And if you want to go the extra mile and leave a nice rating and review, let us know you did so with an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we'll hook you up with a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.